Welcome to the Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles. I'm your host, Nat Cardona. On the last episode, we discussed the climate leading into the 1968 Orangeburg Massacre in Orangeburg, South Carolina. If you haven't listened to that episode, please go back and listen. There's a link in the show notes to help make it easier for you to find. In this week's episode, I'm again joined by Dr. William Hine. He's a former history professor at South Carolina State University. We discuss in detail how the peaceful protest by students was met with violence from law enforcement. We also go into who was or wasn't held responsible for the deaths of three students and the wounding of more than 20 others. And with that, let's get to it. So you have this pressure cooker of tensions for a handful of years, nights before the actual event happens. What's the tipping point? What's the other shoe that dropped to turn from, you know, a lot of tension to violence? What was the thing that happened that night?
That's it. There is nothing. I mean, they were there. They confronted each other and went back and forth for time. As I mentioned, there was a bonfire that was put out. People continued to throw things. At one point, an officer of the highway patrol, man named Sheely, got it looked like he'd been shot almost literally between the eyes. He went down. At least semi-conscious for a period of time, bleeding profusely, and it appeared as if he had been shot from the direction of the students. As it turned out, he had not been shot. He'd been hit with a heavy piece of timber. It had opened a wound on his forehead. They took him off to the hospital, and at least another 10 minutes or more elapsed after Sheely was hit with the timber. A lot of people were at the time and since under the mistaken impression, well, Sheely got hit and then the highway patrolman opened fire. Didn't happen. It did not happen that way. They opened fire with no announcement that they were going to fire. Nobody said lock and load or you have 1 minute or 180 seconds to retreat or we're going to open fire. It was unannounced. They just simply started shooting. Not all the highway patrolmen shot. There were 66 of them aligned along the embankment and kind of curled around at right angles toward an unoccupied house next door to the campus there. Some opened fire, some did not. Most of the students were hit in the back as they turned to run from the shotgun blasts, more than 30 were hit, and three were killed, and at least 28 were injured, some superficially, some very seriously. There was no ready aim fire. It was just a spontaneous opening of fire. Later, it was determined that apparently one of the highway patrol officers had fired a warning shot into the air with his sidearm, and others, not realizing that, opened fire, hearing a weapon go off. That's been about the best determination of how the highway patrolman came to open fire that night, roughly 10:30, 10:45 on February 8th.
Okay. So you have a bunch of these young people wounded. Three young men ultimately are massacred or killed. Can you talk a little bit about those three young men, if you don't mind?
Well, two of them were college students. One was a high school student. They were there as much out of curiosity as a determination that they're going to be involved in protests. Henry Smith was probably the most active of the students. He wanted to be there. He did consider himself an activist. He was upset with conditions in the community and on the campus. There's no question of his involvement, his determination to be a part of this. The other college student was a freshman football player named Samuel Hammond from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He was there out of interest and curiosity. He was there with several other football players and athletes as well. He was shot and died shortly after that. Then there was Delano Middleton, who was the high school student. His mother worked on the campus, and he kind of came up to see what was happening on the front of the campus, and he was hit and fatally injured as well that night. He was local. He was from the Orangeburg area. Henry Smith was from Marion, probably 100 miles. He came from a poor family over there. And as I mentioned, Samuel Hammond was an athlete from Fort Lauderdale, although his father was from down the road from Orangeburg and Bamberg, South Carolina. And so they had connections and roots to the local area as well.
Okay. Unfortunately, they're killed and other people are wounded. And then what? Like, what is that rest of the night like? What happens pretty much immediately after?
Well, it was chaos initially on the campus. I mean, there was fear, one, that this was just a prelude to an invasion by law enforcement. They were going to head on and through the campus and maybe continue shooting or occupy the campus. No one knew what was going on. There was an absence of communication of any time. They were taking wounded students out the back side of the campus and going to the hospital by a back route. The college infirmary was filled with bleeding students. There was great fear, anger, trepidation about what's next here. And it took a number of hours for this to settle down. In the meantime, the accounts that went out through the media were, incomplete and false, as it turned out, as well. The Associated Press, AP, sent out an account that there'd been an exchange of gunfire on the campus with students shooting at highway patrolmen and patrolmen shooting back for that. And that was absolutely incorrect. And it was never corrected by AP either. So the headlines, such as they were, that appeared the next day was that there'd been an exchange of gunfire. And the governor and the local authorities were pretty well convinced that they'd saved Orangeburg from some kind of massive Black nationalist uprising. And as regrettable as it was that students got shot, that this was necessary to protect the community, protect the lives and property of people in Orangeburg. And the governor maintained that and continued to maintain that as days and weeks and then months and even years went by. After that, he was convinced that he'd acted properly and that he had helped to preserve security, preserve what threatened to become a much worse situation from exploding into that. And that is, to a large extent, the conventional story that was heard in the aftermath of the massacre, except for the Black press that did cover it, the Black newspapers at the time, the Baltimore Afro-American, the Pittsburgh Courier, and the Chicago Defender, Jet Magazine. I mean, they covered it, but as far as most people in the Black community were concerned, those were just cold-blooded murder by armed highway patrolmen, all white, who shot into a crowd of Black young men protesting on their own campus, unarmed at the time. So there are two versions that prevailed for many days, weeks, and months, even years, to the present day, about what actually happened that night in 1968.
Sure. We need to take a quick break, so don't go too far. Just so listeners understand, there were, out of the 70 or so patrolmen, 9 were charged with shooting at protesters, but ultimately none were convicted of anything. Totally just wiped clean. No one held accountable for the murders or the shootings, anything, correct?
That is correct. The U.S. Department of Justice tried to indict the 9 highway patrolmen who did admit shooting into the crowd of students. A federal grand jury in Columbia in the fall of 1968 refused to indict them on felony charges. And the Department of Justice then indicted them on misdemeanor charges, criminal information, and they went on trial the following spring of 1969 in federal court in Florence, South Carolina. And a jury of 10 white people and 2 black people found them not guilty, that they had felt their lives were in danger, and therefore they were justified in shooting into this crowd of students, even if the students weren't armed with weapons. And so the 9 highway patrolmen were indeed acquitted. And then a year after that, Cleveland Sellers was brought to the bar of justice in Orangeburg, and he was charged with an assortment of charges, including inciting a riot there. As it turned out, most of the charges were abandoned, and he was finally convicted, not for what happened on the night of February 8th, but on the night of February 6th at the bowling alley, of inciting the crowd down there. And he was sentenced to a year in state prison in the Broad River State Correctional Institution. He served 9 months. He was released early on good behavior. So he's the only one who was penalized for the events surrounding the Orangeburg Massacre in 1968. And I should point out that he was one of the people shot and wounded that night as well. He was hit in the upper arm by shotgun pellets there. So he had to face the indignity of going to jail and being shot as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm really, really hoping to still hear back from him to hear just his retelling of everything that happened. But thanks for laying that all out. So yeah, ultimately, he's the only one who's punished for anything that had happened that night. And at the end of the day, no justice was served for the 3 young men that were killed. And, you know, here we are today. It's going on, what, 55, 56 years later. How did we get here to where this major event that actually was so integral to the civil rights movement and so violent on top of it? How did we get to the point where this is just a blip on the radar in history, especially in terms with this? Do you have any input on that?
Well, the circumstances under which it happened in 1968, it was not well covered at that time. 1968 was a very tumultuous year in American history. At the time of the massacre in early February, the Tet Offensive was breaking out in Vietnam. The Vietnam War absorbed the attention of many, many Americans and the media. Shortly before that, in January, at an American naval vessel, the Pueblo, had been captured by North Korea and its crew taken hostage. And then only weeks after the massacre, the sitting president, Lyndon Johnson, announced that he would not be running for re-election in 1968. And days after that, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot in Memphis, Tennessee. And then a couple of months after that, Robert Kennedy was shot after the Democratic primary in California, shot in Los Angeles, and he died a day or so later. And the massacre got lost in this series of events. Add to that, it happens in a small rural town in South Carolina. And then most importantly, it was a group of Black students, and it simply did not draw the attention or the coverage of most people, especially most white people. It did, as I mentioned, draw the coverage of the Black press and Black students at other HBCUs, other historically Black colleges and universities, North Carolina A&T and Morehouse and Howard in Washington. It was largely overlooked. There was no story in Time magazine. There was a short story in Newsweek at the time. The media, in terms of television, gave it very, very little attention. And what little attention it did give it disappeared very quickly. So most people never even heard of it. It didn't get into most of the history books. And 2 years later, when the shootings occurred at Kent State, it just exploded across the front pages of newspapers and on all of the major networks, CBS and NBC and ABC at that time. And so virtually everyone in the aftermath of Kent State knew about the shootings of the four students at Kent, who were all white, hardly anyone had heard of the students who had been shot at South Carolina State who were Black.
Which, thank you for bringing that up, because with your affiliation with the college, from my understanding, student organizations have done a pretty good job of remembering what had happened there. I understand that there are statues of the three young men on campus, or is that just
in Lynchburg? No, that's on campus.
Okay.
There's a memorial plaza there. The year after the massacre in 1969, a small granite marker was placed there with the names of the three young men. And then 30 plus years after that, there were bronze tablets established around that granite marker with the names of the 28 young men who were wounded there. And then 3 years ago or so, a brick monument was created, built there. And then 2 years ago, there were busts of the three young men placed within that brick and lighted a monument, the busts of Henry Smith and Delano Middleton and Samuel Hammond are there. So there is a monument on campus that has expanded over the years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good to know. Thank you for clarifying all of that. One of the last things here is, you know, we can't change the past and how it was covered and portrayed and how no justice was done and all of that. But what would the takeaway you would hope for listeners to get out of this or for people to learn from this? Do you have anything that you'd like to kind of part with?
Well, you would hope that people would learn that you don't have law enforcement shoot into a crowd of unarmed people. But the fact of the matter is, they did it and did it again and then shot into a crowd of protesting white students at Kent State in May of 1970. And unfortunately, too often, law enforcement officers have taken it upon themselves to not only enforce the law, but apparently act as a jury and convict and punish those who they see protesting, demonstrating, breaking the law in front of them. So that's one lesson that has regrettably not been learned very much, if at all, in the years and decades since then. The other regret, as far as I'm concerned, and many other people who were involved with the massacre and those who survived it, is that there was never any formal investigation of what happened and why it happened. There was a presidential commission formed after the Kent State killings on campus violence. Richard Nixon appointed the former governor of Pennsylvania, William Scranton, and they did a thorough investigation of what happened at Kent State, what happened at Jackson State. They pretty much ignored Orangeburg to try to get at the problems that led to the shootings at Jackson State and Kent State in May of 1970. There have been other state investigations of racially involved incidents everywhere from Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1923 to Rosewood, Florida in 1920 to more recent developments. But there was never a state or federal investigation of what happened in Orangeburg, an effort to try to get into the underlying factors that contributed to this, to try to bring some increased clarity. I don't know that would bring closure to this. It might help. It might assist in that. But it has never happened. And in terms of the foreseeable future, it doesn't look like it is going to happen.
But in theory, it could still happen. That would be the hope, certainly. Ultimately. Okay. It's never too late.
People have suggested. No, it's not. I mean, they investigated Tulsa almost 100 years after it happened, and Rosewood as well. Tulsa was 1921, and Rosewood was 1923. And the state of Florida and the state of Oklahoma did investigate those. They appointed people. They set aside relatively small amounts of money on this, and then tried to undertake a thorough examination of events that had occurred many decades before. Now we're more than a half century since Orangeburg. There's still no investigation, and there seems to be little inclination on the part of political leaders to undertake such an investigation, even though it would be of modest cost. The attitude seems to be, well, we don't need to bring that up again. Don't let us pick the scab on that wound again. Let's just let it go. We can move on, and we'll live in a better, happier future without digging into the past and stirring up the animosity and hard feelings once again. So we don't need an investigation like that, and quit harping on it and quit suggesting that we do. And in fact, it's about time you stopped having those ceremonies each February 8th to commemorate this. It only inflames people in the community, and people get upset with this, and we'd rather not it happened. I should say that helping with that has been the local newspaper, the Times and Democrat. They have done a lot in recent years to try to bring about some healing and some efforts to recognize what happened in the community as a serious tragedy, and the loss of life and the injuries that occurred. And they've tried to bring people together in terms of healing with efforts to bring community leaders together to agree, at least not to be so emotionally invested in this that they have a hard time even speaking with each other. So the Times and Democrat and Kathy Hughes and Lee Harder have helped a lot there.
Is there anything that you would like to add before we part our ways?
No, I would repeat the what I've almost repeated over the years ad nauseum now about the the need for an investigation. We're losing people. We in the past year, two of the young men who were wounded in 1968 have died since the fall of 2022, and that's it's regrettable. But as the cliche goes, better late than never. So I would repeat a call for an investigation. It won't answer all the questions. It won't satisfy everyone, but I think it will help bring about an understanding of one of the most traumatic events that occurred in South Carolina in the 20th century. So on that note, I would close.
That's a great note to close on. I really appreciate your time. This was honestly way more information than I actually expected. So huge. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And that's where we'll end the show for today. If you're interested in more details of how the victims of the massacre are being memorialized, please check out the articles linked in our show notes. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you don't miss what's coming next from Crime Beat Chronicles. Thanks for listening.